Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. You're listening to Rabble Radio for October 2016. I'm Victoria Fenner. Today's question, what does it take to build stronger communities? A lot of it is about participation. When we work together for the common good, the places where we live become stronger. We know our neighbors, we help each other. In healthy communities, people are engaged with each other. But what does that mean? Today's program is about engagement, connecting, and making a difference in the places where we live. How do we strengthen those ties that bind? A few ideas here on Rabble Radio. What does it mean to belong? That's a question the Community Foundations of Canada asked this year in their study, Vital Signs. If ideas are food for thought, this report is Canada's biggest food court. This current study is a multi-year and multifaceted exploration on the topic of belonging. It's an area of strategic focus for Community Foundations of Canada, a national organization in Ottawa whose membership is the individual community foundations across the country. In case you don't know what a community foundation is, most places in Canada have a community foundation. It's a way of organizing donations. If a person has money to donate, they can go to the local community foundation to set up and administer the funds for them. I used to think that these organizations would lean towards socially conservative types of charities, like symphony orchestras, children's charities providing after-school activities, that kind of thing, but nothing controversial. So I was pleasantly surprised to see that one of the things they looked at in this report was about activism. Lee Rose is Director of Community Knowledge for Community Foundations of Canada. I asked him why they now consider activism to be a part of community building.
I think this is one of those ones that, for me, that also sort of activism is important. I think it's especially in the charitable sector, sometimes we've had this sort of this advocacy chill over the past. We talk about the audits with the environmental organizations and the CRA, but also in terms of like the shift that happens in change. Like, it's most of the time when something really positive changes in the community, it starts with someone who speaks up, who says, no, this is not the way it should be, who is challenging the status quo. And that, as you're agitating for change, you're also building community. If someone is taking the time and the effort to say, hey, we need to fix something, that to me is the biggest sign of a community builder who's really trying to change things and at the grassroots. And we see the systems change happen through activism. And I think that it is sometimes it's seen as a dirty word. It's seen, we see the protests and we see the people being arrested and all those kinds of things. But I think, activism that's important. I think it is important to have those voices. But it's also important to realize that, being involved in your community and taking a stand or, writing a letter to the editor or contacting your MP, that is a form of activism. And it's important. That is what makes community and that's what makes our democracy stronger.
That was a pretty bold statement that you made there. I mean, did you get any flack for it or were there people who said, no, activism really is not how we do things. It's not the way to create change and it's too confrontational?
I think so. This is I think we get into the challenge of words. When we did the report, we did think about, okay, is that the right word for us to use? And I, really strongly believe that it is a form of participation. And it just seemed obtuse to us to not include something where, we are, because we've seen the evidence that people who are active in their community in ways are more engaged. We see that 38% of Canadians feel like they don't have a stake in their community, but those that do are agitating for change and are creating, along the same time, a sense of belonging to their community and involving other people in this process. At all levels, I think, at the community level, at the national level, I think people who are more engaged in their community in a number of ways, have this greater sense of belonging, and are seeing the positive changes they want to see, and are actively being a part of the change they want to see in their community, rather than being, you know, externalizing that and waiting for someone else to take action.
Right. So now when you look, is this the first time that you've done this report, or have you been working on it for like several iterations of the Vital Signs reports? Because it's been coming out for a few years now, hasn't it?
Yeah, so we've had Vital Signs is about 15 years, the program. The national report, we've had a focus on belonging for the national Vital Signs report since last year. So last year, we have a three-year kind of trajectory with what we're looking at as belonging as kind of an issue. Last year, we really kind of, you know, answered the questions like, what does belonging look like? And we looked back at Canada in 1967 and compared that to, you know, Canada today and seeing how it's changed, the demographics of our country are changing and how that's affecting belonging, migration patterns, the English-French question, our challenges with reconciliation, all of these things that are affecting, you know, the Canadian landscape. This year, we decided to look at, you know, that we see belonging as a two-way street. That, you know, it's about us as individuals and making our contributions to community. And then also the other side, which we're going to look at next year, is what is the role of the institutions in our communities? What's the role of your local library, the academic institutions, the community organizations, the neighborhood houses, and, you know, the church or the other places? What is their role in creating, you know, communities where everyone feels like they belong? It's a huge issue. You know, we couldn't do it all in one year. But I'm really excited about this journey that we're taking and the conversations that we're having with people about belonging being a really good sort of wrapper, I guess, for a number of some of the social things that we're dealing with, like housing, homelessness, newcomer settlement, all of these things, you know, we can tie back to a sense of belonging.
There are a lot of numbers in the report, very, very well done, really easy to read, but how do you quantify what it means to belong?
I think it's hard to put a number on a sense of belonging. It's more of a feeling, right? Then we talk about a sense of belonging and a sense of, you know, being a part of a place. And we tend to think of it as a two-way street. It's about us as individuals wanting to participate and putting ourselves out there into the community. But it's also about the other side of the street, the community and the institutions and, you know, the neighborhoods sending signals of acceptance and saying that, yeah, you're welcome here, and this is a place where you belong.
So some of the things that you've pointed out in the report, first of all, I think the statistic that volunteer rates have plummeted, what do you think that means for our communities?
I think it's interesting because that's typically the way that we've described, you know, social participation has been three ways. It's been giving, volunteering, and voting. Those, and all three of those are in decline. And in the research that we were looking at, it's like, well, are communities any worse off? And I don't think they are. I think that we're just sort of looking at participation in a different way. And in the report, we outline, okay, these things are kind of plateauing. Volunteer rates are staying the same. Donations are going down. Voter turnout is going down. The last election, you know, yet to be seen if that's a blip or if that's a back up on the upward trend. But, you know, how are the other ways that we're participating? And, you know, we brainstormed some stuff, you know, here and thinking about it. What is participation 2.0 look like? If we move away from giving, voting, and volunteering, you know, how else are people contributing and participating in community? And, you know, there are a number of ways. And in the report, we highlight five. So the arts, faith, or spirituality, digital or online, sport and activism, which I think is a really compelling one too, but these are ways that people are getting involved that aren't always measured in a statistic or caught in a report from StatsCan.
Are you alone in this new way of measuring and looking at society? It seems to me that those are always the benchmarks that governments and civil society organizations have been looking at forever. Is there a new trend now?
I hope so. I think that it's a very, you know, relying on giving, voting, and volunteering is sort of the metrics of participation. I don't think you get the whole picture of how people engage in community. And I know that our work in community foundations across the country, we're seeing that people are getting involved in other ways and making meaningful contributions to community in ways that can't be measured or tracked in the same way that, you know, voter turnout and donations run through with tax receipts can be measured. So it's this, you know, it's harder to track, and I think this is interesting where we're, you know, we put together a report that uses a lot of statistics and a lot of information. But it's, I think for me, it's much more about those softer things that are not necessarily the stats. It's like, you know, people that go to, you know, we know that people that go to church or synagogue or mosque have a greater sense of belonging. And what is it about that? We know that it's actually not just the spiritual part of it. It's actually the sense of getting together with other people. And how do you track that on a survey? It's quite difficult to sort of get these things that aren't necessarily statistically sound. But it paints an interesting picture of how, you know, we tend to rely on these numbers, but then I don't think we're getting the full picture by just relying on just the stats.
Right. And it was interesting, too, that you also had a substantial section on online, because there are so many people who say, well, if you're online, you're thinking globally and it's cutting you off from your community. But you think there's a different way of looking at that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think, you know, it's funny, we tend to think of, you know, I have children as well, and I think, guys, get off the phones and go out and play with your friends. And you know, get out of the basement and get out and do stuff. And I think that, you know, the presumption is that people are on their phones, they're less connected. But, you know, the research is showing that people who are active on social media are more likely to visit their friends in person and are more likely to get involved in their community, you know, whether that's global or local. So we see the internet as kind of this high-speed connection to community. And it's really interesting, too, in communities, especially in Canada's north. We have great stories of how communities in the north are using technology like Facebook to connect to Indigenous languages and revive old languages that, you know, are on the brink of extinction. And they're doing it, it's interesting, using these traditional languages, but using a digital platform to create community around an Indigenous language.
That was Lee Rose, Director of Community Knowledge for Community Foundations of Canada. He's the author of this year's Vital Signs Report, a yearly study which measures the vitality of our communities and how we can work together to improve the quality of life in the places where we live. You can find out more by going to communityfoundations.ca/vital signs. It's hard to be engaged in our communities if we don't know what's going on. Healthy, informative media which connects people is a really important element. Things like, what's going on at City Hall that might affect me? I feel like I want to go to a play this weekend. What's on? Why is that noisy piece of big equipment tearing down that building at the end of my street? We used to have radio stations with news departments that covered that kind of thing. Television stations that covered local politics. And local newspapers that actually reported news. Traditionally, our media has been brought to us by businesses that allocated part of their revenue to the production of local news and information. But not anymore. Commercial media businesses are taking advertising dollars out of our communities and not giving much back. That's especially true of Canada's cable television providers. For over 40 years, community cable channels and production studios have been provided by the commercial cable companies. It was part of a deal they made with the CRTC for the privilege of making lots of money from cable subscriptions. But that's eroding too. Kathy Edwards is executive director of CACTUS, which stands for the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations. CACTUS is advocating for a new media model in Canada, which will serve communities in a way that the for-profit models are increasingly unable or unwilling to do. Kathy explains the reasons why they're advocating for change.
Well, CACTUS was formed by lots of people that used to work and volunteer in that cable community television system. But over the last decade and a half, we've seen those channels close. And not everybody has cable anymore. So the television landscape is so much more complicated. It doesn't work to just have a community TV station that's only on cable. That means like 40% of your community can't see it. So a lot of those people got together and said, you know, we need another solution, which is community-based. So there is a license class now, thanks to interventions by our members, where you can get a not-for-profit community television license, which is broadcast over the air, on cable, on satellite, and stream, so the whole community can see it. So that was one thing, was to address the problem with shrinking access to cable. But secondly, the landscape's been changing. So as I said, people need a lot more media skills than just producing radio or television now to function in the digital environment. You need other skills. So what we talk about is community media centers. So imagine walking into your public library or a community center or another building, whatever. It could evolve out of an existing community TV or radio station, but you can get courses in everything from video gaming to how do I use social media, how do I make a video, how do I make a podcast. So it's under one roof so that if you've got an event to publicize, you can go to one place, work with somebody to figure out how to promote it, and then, you know, use the media tools that are going to help you the most in that situation. So it's not cut up all over the place. It's so there's one-stop shopping for people to keep up.
So, and how is this kind of community media that you're describing, how does that contribute to community vitality and community building?
Well, I'll give you one example. Will Amos, the Member of Parliament for the Pontiac here north of Ottawa, was holding a town hall meeting last night about proportional voting, you know, the consideration of new voting systems. These town halls are happening all across the country. But there was about 25, 30 people in the room. You know, in our riding, which has got several tens of thousands of people, that means nobody else was involved in that conversation. Now, they could have potentially gone to those meetings, and maybe the fact that they weren't there means they're not interested. But I don't think so, because if you say to yourself, well, where were those meetings advertised? There's a little online newspaper called The Lowdown, which is text only and not even in French. Our riding's bilingual. So most of the people in our riding wouldn't even know that that meeting took place. And secondly, for all the people that couldn't go, there's nowhere to access what was said at that meeting or those ideas after the fact. So community media builds community in making events and discussions and dialogue visible and transparent for everyone, even if you can't show up in person for these events. So it's just greasing the wheels of communication in the community so that we understand one another, so that the issues are out there. Commercial interests often aren't providing that service. So Cactus and Community Radio and other groups got together last year and conducted a survey of community media accessibility across the country and confirmed what a lot of other sources were saying, which that community, you know, small town newspapers have closed en masse. They often get bought up by bigger groups that then close them and decide that they're not profitable. And as we mentioned, a lot of community television stations have closed. So there isn't a private presence in small towns. It's not profitable. In bigger towns where there may be private media, they're owned by too few ownership groups. So, for example, there was recently the CRTC reviewed its community television policy, and just as an example of coverage of one issue, there was one article written about that in all of English Canada. You know, it was a national new policy around local and community TV, you know, affects the whole country. There was exactly one freelance article written by one journalist with one point of view that was republished in more than 20 papers across the country, you know, all properties of the Financial Post. In English Canada, same thing. One French article came out, which said almost the same thing. Both articles came from the Canadian press freelance journalist, La Presse Canadienne, on the French side. 18 small newspapers, all owned by the same ownership groups, and Quebec reprinted it. So there's just no variety in the media that you're seeing. And if there's no community media where people are given tools and platforms to express themselves either, then there's no balance for it.
What kinds of things is Cactus doing now to try and create change to how communities and media are happening in Canada?
Well, last year, as I mentioned, we did research. We got together with other community media so that we could have a coherent policy proposal developed with lots of input. So we had an online survey and focus groups, and that research was then sort of tested amongst ourselves at a conference last fall. And then we submitted that policy proposal to support community media in the digital environment to the CRTC's review of its local TV and community TV policy last spring. They completely ignored the policy, unfortunately. But the good news is the new government, the Liberal government, under the Heritage Minister, Mélanie Joly, is doing a consultation this fall called Canadian Content in the Digital Environment, which is open to all Canadians online. If you Google Canadian content in the digital world, it'll pop up. Anybody can upload reports, so we will, or just, you know, type an offhand comment in a little box so everyone can participate.
Well, it sounds to me that what you're doing is presenting a new vision in terms of how media is, you know, is produced in communities, because the traditional model, which is the old way, commercial radio stations, commercial TV stations, commercial newspapers, websites, that kind of thing, do it to make money. It sounds like your approach is that it doesn't have to be about making money.
Right, but it's not new in the sense that Canada used to be a policy leader in community media. There was always recognition, you know, in the Canadian Broadcasting Act that there's the public sector, which isn't about making money either. It's supposed to also serve niche groups and be diverse and so on. There was the private sector that could basically do whatever it wanted, although there was some expectation that, you know, a body of it should be Canadian. But then there was the community element that members in the community also should be able to freely participate in our broadcasting system. Otherwise, we don't live in a democracy. There's no free speech if all you can do is stand on a street corner with a bullhorn. So the recognition has always been there. It's just with the rapid change in the digital environment in the last 10 or 15 years, frankly, policymakers have kind of gotten confused themselves with all these new platforms and tools. You know, where do we focus our policy efforts? And like I said, there's been some confusion that just because camcorders are now cheap and anyone can get on the internet and YouTube, suddenly that replaces the need for community media. But there's a failure to recognize that it still costs money to whether you're doing it professionally or doing it at the community level, to learn to interview properly, to cover political events, to learn investigative journalism techniques, to create a drama. This doesn't happen just because you have a $200 camcorder and access to a YouTube account. It still takes money to create good content. Whether you're training people to do it at the community level or doing it at the professional level, you still need that public support for all community media, and that in communities you can find support for creating media on new platforms, not just traditional platforms. We have developed a petition with the assistance of NDP and Liberal MPs, which is going to be presented in Parliament starting in a couple of weeks' time. The same petition will be presented in multiple ridings across the country. So our members and supporters and friends are out busily collecting signatures for that petition right now.
What's the focus of the petition?
So the petition says that in view of the new digital platforms and the new challenges for people to express themselves and have technical support and training to express themselves in the digital environment, on the one hand. Secondly, because of shrinking access to media for local communities, smaller communities especially. And thirdly, the virtual elimination of community television across Canada. Because of those three reasons, we're asking for support for community media centres across the country. So a new model that's platform neutral, so that people can have the training tools they need and access to platforms to put out their messages from small communities to large. So the petition is available on Cactus's website. So if you go to cactus.independentmedia.ca, or if you just Google Cactus or Google the Canadian Association of Community TV, our website will pop up. There's a copy of the petition on the front page. People can download it and sign it if they like. It's a paper petition. What we were told is that rather than doing one online petition, which would be presented by one MP in Parliament, that it's actually much more effective to go the old-fashioned route of collecting paper petitions in multiple ridings across the country. And this is really beneficial. Then there's a conversation going on at the riding level with the media needs of that riding. And then multiple MPs will present that same petition throughout the next couple of months in Parliament. And the Heritage Minister and parliamentarians will see that this is a need across the country. It's not restricted to a particular MP, particular party, or a particular riding.
That was Kathy Edwards, Executive Director of CACTUS, the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations. You can find out more by going to cactus.independentmedia.ca. Speaking of community and media, I discovered a great radio series.
Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. La Fondation canadienne pour le dialogue des cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
There are a whole bunch of programs that have been produced by community radio stations across Canada. There's a new batch in production right now, and some of them are done. They're on the air at a community radio station near you, and on the net. There's lots of great listening, exploring our Francophone communities in various parts of the country. One of my favorites is by Christian Gagné of CJAM at the University of Windsor. The reason why I like this episode so much is because that's the area of the country where all branches of my family settled after arriving from Europe. And yes, one branch of the family, the Deloriers, were French. Here's an excerpt from Chris's program.
If you look at a map of the Windsor-Detroit Essex County area, you will see many geographical names of French origin. Detroit itself is a French word. La Salle, Pêche Island, Boblo Island, Pointe Pelee, Pointe Roche, River Canard, the Puce River, Bell River, Jeanette's Creek, Lake St. Clair. These are all French place names. Windsor is obviously an English name. The royal family's last name is Windsor. And historical records show that this name was in use by the 1840s in reference to the city across the river on the south shore from Detroit, what would become the city of Windsor. However, for 100 years, the south shore of the Detroit River was known as La Petite Côte, the Little Coast in English. It was so named because to the voyageurs who traveled up and down these waters in the 18th and 19th centuries, the south shore was a relatively short strip of land between Lake Erie and Lake St. Clair as compared to the north shore. And of course, then there are the street names, which are very illustrative of the original Francophone settlers. In Windsor and LaSalle, we see Bobby Street, Jeanette, Karen, Polisher, Olette, Lewis Street, Marentette, Parent, Langlois, Peary Street, Pilette, Joseph Janice Street, Isabel, Belle Perche, Lauzon, Dieppe, Shane, L'Espérance, Lacasse, Rayom, Bouffard, Laurier, Boismier. These names remain prominent amongst the people who live in this region to this day, the descendants of the original Francophone pioneers. In Detroit, we see a wealth of French street names. Livernois, Bondy, Labadie, Salyotte, Leblanc, Lafayette, Saint-Anne, Saint-Antoine, Dubois, Shane, Campeau, Beaufay, Marquette, Saint-Jean, Balfour, Rivaud, Grosse Pointe, Provençal, or Provençal, Vernier, Michaud, Beaubien, Riopelle, Gratiot, so many French names in Detroit. These streets start at the North Shore and extend into the interior of what is now the city of Detroit and reflect the seigneurial system, a semi-feudal system of land distribution used in New France and also here in the Windsor area. This style of land distribution contrasts with the British grid pattern of square land parcels that surround the respective downtown cores of Windsor and Detroit. The earlier seigneurial arrangement survives in the street names that fringe the banks of the Detroit River.
That was an excerpt from Christian Gagné's program about Francophone culture in Canada's Deep South, Windsor, Essex County. There's lots of good listening about various places in Canada. You'll hear things you didn't know about before. To hear more, you can go to www.ncra.ca/RVF. And that's our program for October 2016. And just a reminder, Vital Thriving Communities is all about people caring, getting involved, and not just being passive bystanders. Since you're a Rabble listener and reader, we don't have to tell you that. You don't just read, you also take action. We'd like to know even more about you at Rabble. We invite you to go to our 2016 Readers and Listeners survey. It will help us figure out how we can serve you even better with the stories we bring you. Go to rabble.ca/whoareyouanyway and tell us more about yourself. I'm Victoria Fenner, Executive Producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Rabble Radio is a production of rabble.ca. Thanks for listening. Thank you.